It's time to get nerdy, y'all.
A little bit of gaming history for you.
Something relevant in gaming and discuss our opinions on it.
Should we kick it out of here or should we kick start it?
This is the part where you, the listeners, try to stump the hosts.
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, lads and lasses of all ages, welcome to the show. It is Tuesday, December 5th, 2023, and it's time to get nerdy. Welcome to episode 291 of Two Nerds in a Pod, the nerdiest gaming podcast in the multiverse. I am Maxion, and I am joined today by my fellow comrade in gaming commentary, my bestie, Mr. Nice Guy 425, also known as Slom Galuka, stand-up comedian, stand-up guy. And for the next hour, we're going to talk about everything from legalese to news as it relates to video gaming. Thanks for joining us. But first, Mr. Nice Guy, it has been a week and it's good to see you.
It's good to see you too, man. And it was a really good week. This weekend was a lot of fun, very hectic. We had the 7th annual Galuka Christmas party here in my home.
Yeah.
And you may notice the background is a little bit different. We moved the arcade machines.
Mm-hmm.
I had taken my computer down and hidden it. And I was in a mad rush to get it put back up before the ep tonight. But dude, we had 77 people come through this year, which I'm not sure if it's a record, but it was a lot of fun. I smoked some wings. My wife made homemade donuts. We had cider. We had treats that my wife made. People brought stuff. We had chips and dip. More importantly, we had great conversation with great people and spread some holiday cheer. And I don't know if you knew this, Mac, but the best way to spread Christmas cheer is singing loud for all to hear, which we did not do, but I like that movie, so I figured I'd quote it. Great weekend. How was your weekend, man?
My weekend was full of traveling and craziness. I took advantage of transit to get to a little burg called Bend.
Okay.
Met up with my brother-in-law. He was planning on, you know, moving, so we were looking at houses, and I was there to be, you know, I was there to be his co-pilot.
Nice.
At the end of it, though, as it turns out, it snowed and the mountain passes were all closed and I had to get over those mountains. So instead of being able to just do a nice leisurely trip back through the passes, I had to rent a car and drive myself, you know, 6 hours around the mountains in order to, get back to where I needed to be, which was unfortunate. But, you know, it was a thing. It was an adventure. Don't plan on repeating that part of the adventure, but everything else, you know, good food, good times, good people is, I think, what I would say about my week.
Nice. Well, dude, sometimes it's more fun to have too much to do than it is to have, you know, less than too much to do. Neither of I know what that's like because we're both very, very busy with podcasting and learning new skills and doing different things. But I'm glad you had a busy and a fun weekend. And now it's time to have a busy and a fun episode. Thank you to everyone who is here live for episode 291. And Mac, I say we do what we do best and hop right up in that gaming news, my friend. What do you think about that?
Absolutely, Mr. Nice Guy. I expect that it has been a tame week in video gaming.
Yeah, it's been a tame week. You know, people are excited for the Game Awards. Even in the chat, we got some people talking about that. I think that's stealing a lot of thunder of other stuff. But Mac, I want to talk to you about a feel-good story. About a story involving an amusement park. This is from GameSpot.com by Jason Finelli. Here's what he writes. When Super Nintendo World first opened at Universal Studios Japan in 2021, attendees immediately noticed the big door teasing a Donkey Kong-themed expansion to the park. Nintendo and Universal have finally addressed the gorilla in the room, as they have announced Donkey Kong Country will be joining the Super Nintendo World in Japan in spring of next year. The announcement came during a Universal kickoff event held in Japan, which aired a brief CGI teaser trailer for the upcoming Donkey Kong Park. The main attraction appears it will be a minecart-themed roller coaster. This is amazing. But the teaser also shows DK's house and a building with Funky Kong's name on a sign in front of it. Mac, Japan, not close, very far.
Mm.
But if you were to go to Japan to go to Super Nintendo World, what Super Nintendo series would you like to see? And while you're thinking about that, I've got to say, I love Donkey Kong Country, one of my favorite games of all time, DKC2. Got it for my birthday in fifth grade. Excited to someday go to Japan and experience this. But Mac, like, what retro SNES series would you like to see built in real life?
I would love to see a theme park based off of Link to the Past.
I love Link to the Past. A lot of people do. Do you feel like Link to the Past, and I know people are going to think this is a blasphemous question, do you feel like it has enough content to make its own world? Donkey Kong Country, to me, it's a country. Link to the Past, yeah, it's a kingdom, right? It's a kingdom. But who, like, what characters are you really excited to see? Link, Zelda, Ganon. With Donkey Kong Country, you got Funky Kong, you got Diddy Kong, you got Donkey Kong. You got a lot of Kongs. I don't know, I just named three. But there's a lot of Kongs that you could see. I don't know.
I don't know what all they would do putting a whole Donkey Kong world together, aside from the minecart roller coaster, which seems pitch perfect and fantastic. But in my mind, I just kind of imagine one or two things for a Legend of Zelda area, and that'd be, you know, you can get yourself a Hylian shield. Maybe, you know, they're selling boots with wings on them, so it's Pegasus boots and a dash and such. I don't know, or maybe one of these days they really go all in on an augmented reality type attraction where you're walking around in an area swinging on octo rocks or keys or something like that.
Yeah.
I think we have the technology. We could make it happen. But I leave it up to those clevers. Now, Nintendo, remember, let us hook us up with tickets and a flight when you inevitably use this idea, because Mr. Nice Guy and I need to be there, naturally.
Nintendo be listening. Someone in the chat said Shaq Fu, but they're kidding. Yeah, I don't want to see a Shaq Fu world. Mm-hmm. Well, cool. Let's move on to our next news story. Mac, I want to chat with you about the PlayStation Portal. Let me just start by reading the title of this review on Engadget, written by, who's it written by? You got to put your name at the top. Devendra Hardawar. Here's the title: PlayStation Portal Review, A Baffling Handheld for No One But Sony Diehards. Sony has apparently learned nothing from the success of Nintendo Switch and Steam Deck, or from its own portable systems like the Vita and the PSP for that matter. The PlayStation Portal is a $200 handheld system that can only stream games from your PlayStation 5. There aren't any built-in apps, and it can't play anything locally, and there's no connection to Sony's cloud game streaming service. It's purely a streaming window to your PS5, hence the name. Consequently, it's also a device that lives and dies based on the quality of your internet connection. While it's mostly meant for in-home play, you could technically hop on any Wi-Fi connection to play remotely while you're traveling. But that's only possible if that connection and your home internet can keep up, and if your PS5 doesn't crash or get wonky. If anything along that chain fails, you're left with an ugly $200 doorstop. I know you probably haven't, like me, been watching tons of reviews of the PlayStation Portal. I also know that you're not a PlayStation person particularly, but the idea of a device that strictly does remote play, when there are other ways of doing remote play, namely the Backbone controller, which I'm assuming you're familiar with, namely a tablet like an iPad or an Android tablet with a controller, accomplishes the same thing. Like, what do you think about the concept of this device? Awesome or too derivative of other things that we have?
I think it certainly fills a niche, but I think as we were leading into, you know, not just the original announcement of the PlayStation Portal, but also its release,
right?
I feel like you had expressed some concern that, you know, you already had the capability to do everything, and this portal was probably not going to see much play. You've got enough screens available to you that having the kids playing Switch on the screen and you playing on the portal, while that's a fantastic use case, wasn't going to be necessarily that useful for you. I'm glad that some people can get some, you know, make something of it. A reasonable concern is that, you know, internet infrastructure is not that good in the United States generally, and has never been that good in my own home. So while I don't know if that's a controlling factor for too many people, I certainly feel seen in this moment by this reporter from Engadget.
Yeah, so here's my thoughts. I do have a Steam Deck. I also have a Backbone controller. I like that this device is for the PlayStation diehard. As they said, it's basically a DualSense Edge split in half, so you're getting the haptics with this device that you're not getting on the Steam Deck, right? It also has a microphone built in. It has an 8-inch LCD screen, which is bigger than the one on the Steam Deck. Mm-hmm. And its battery life is better than the Steam Deck from what I've read. I have only seen people say that they either love this or hate it. Sony doesn't allow any Bluetooth headphones other than their own. They said you have to go proprietary for that, which I thought was a weird and probably not smart choice. I will say this about the Portal. I think it's awesome that you can use it outside of your home and still connect to your PS5. Apparently there's a way to do that using port forwarding on the Steam Deck. I haven't been able to do it. I also hear it's not a good idea for network security to do that. But I think it's dope that you could be in Hawaii on a plane with Wi-Fi, somewhere with your phone as a hotspot, and you can connect to your PS5 at home. I've talked about this before. The digital future is now. The fact that you can use this in bed, in another room, in another country, implies that you're not home to switch the discs out of your PlayStation 5. And so it implies that a lot of the games you have are digital. And that if you're going to want to switch games, that you're going to be able to do so without having to call someone who is at your house to do that. So, I don't know. I don't think this is a waste of money. I don't think it's for everyone, but I do think it has its place. And I wanted to kind of give an even-keeled opinion because I haven't heard one on all of the internet. It's either love it or hate it. So, Mac, we're going to keep news short this week, man. That is the news we've got this week.
All right. Well, now that we've looked at what's going on right around us, let's take a little look into the past. Mr. Nice Guy, this last week, we saw some bangers. And I'm going to need to rely on you for at least one of them, because I know that this one's close to your heart.
Sure.
But we'll get to that in a second. First, 1988 for the NES, Zelda 2, The Adventure of Link. And I frankly liked that game, and I'm not going at it with nostalgia glasses because I never played it really when I was a youth. Rather, I played it back in about 2017 or so, played through and beat it, and I really liked it for the most part. A couple of things, of course, were you know, sort of a problem, like, you know, the instructions to go and get the candle in the west when it was absolutely in the east. Nice Guy, did you have any experience with Zelda 2?
My experience is limited. I have played it. It's probably, you know, I'd say it's one of the more controversial Zeldas. Nintendo had a phenomenal formula with the original Zelda, and it was something that was so revolutionary at the time. Top down, you're going around, you're looking in caves, you're doing all kinds of things. I think the visual perspective of seeing things from a bird's eye view was money, and then they decided to go 2D side scroller for the sequel, and so I think that was baffling to a lot of people, and it kind of makes it feel like your exploration is limited. I certainly feel that way, but I still have a soft spot for the game. I think that innovation is something that you try, and if it works, it's great. If it doesn't work, you learn from it. So shout out to them for trying.
Yeah, definitely they took a risk with the side-scrolling, and of course with the, like, RPG mechanics, you know, leveling up certain attributes, you know, lots of different things that they tried that they did, and, you know, some of them worked great, some of them, not so much. But yeah, Zelda 2, I think, an evolution for sure.
Yep.
Well, another one released the year before, actually the launch of the Nintendo Fan Club. Started out as Nintendo Fan Club News. They delivered it quarterly. They only wound up delivering, I believe, 7 or so issues. But it was kind of what you would have expected. It was a thing that read a lot like a news and sort of advice column. You'd have things like, oh, hey, look, for this thing, like they, like in the first issue, they had a thing where they're like, oh, we had this NES event in LA. away, and all these people turned out, and you know, we had a whole bunch of people coming to set high scores in some games, and here's Will Wheaton, and he won, you know, he won the high score and got some prizes and stuff like that. So, you know, lots of cool little, oh, look, we've got these things going on, and then, ah, we have some games coming up. And then the third category of stuff was the advice things, the kinds of things that you would have expected if you called in at, like, the Nintendo hotline. Advice on how to beat a game or what exactly the mechanics were going on. And it's real interesting because the Nintendo Power magazine would come along the following year just as they cut the Nintendo Fan Club. But it certainly feels in a lot of ways like what we came to expect of the publication Nintendo Power. You can see this sort of like roots, the sort of, you know, prototype there in the Nintendo Fan Club news. And while I don't think it would be necessarily fair to characterize the fan club as the, you know, as directly influencing the entirety of Nintendo Power, there's definitely a lot of there's definitely a lot of shared influence there. Well, okay, Mr. Nice Guy, 2001, released for the GameCube, a special title, Super Smash Bros. Melee. And Nice Guy, tell me, why is Melee so beloved?
You know, I don't know, and I've never played Super Smash Bros. Melee. I have played Super Smash Bros. Melee, which is how it's pronounced. The version you're talking of, it must be a bootleg or something. Super Smash Bros. Melee, beloved because Nintendo made it in a way. Mac is smiling because he knows I'm messing with him.
Yeah, he can't hear it. I am smiling. This is good.
Nintendo made it in a way that it was effectively like an esports capable title when Nintendo didn't really want to make games like that. So for context, there were a lot of advanced moves you could pull off. Things like wave dashing, things like L canceling, where you could cancel a move mid-move to counter what an opponent was about to do. All types of advanced techniques that Nintendo almost unintentionally added. And then when it resulted in a very competitive scene, the next game in the series, which is Brawl, didn't have any of that. Because Nintendo really just wanted it to be for kids to have fun and play. I think this is such a big thing that isn't talked about enough, and it's part of why Melee is so beloved. I'll also say it did well because of the success of the GameCube. The GameCube controller, ergonomically, one of the most nostalgic controllers that people still talk about today and still use to play more modern versions of Super Smash Bros. There are literally Nintendo Switch controllers made like the GameCube controller, which is several generations in the past, simply because it's so beloved. So I feel like the combination of that, along with it being the perfect storm of, hey, this is a sequel of the original Smash Brothers. They improved upon things that weren't in the first game. There's way more characters. There's a lot of maps, Final Destination, all types of cool stuff. It just was the perfect storm that made the game so beloved, dude.
Now, there is one thing, Mr. Nice Guy, that I was hoping you could explain to me, a dumb dummy who doesn't really play. Wave dashing.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
So wave dashing, and Spin has kind of summarized what I was saying in the chat. He says, Melee is so influential because it has a huge competitive following and the mechanics never intended to be possible. GameCube controllers along with the mechanics made it amazing. I agree 100%. Thanks for summarizing more succinctly what I was saying, my man. Wave dashing is effectively a way of moving across the screen very, very quickly, where you press the jump button, then you immediately press down and over, and a slide button. So you're going like this, basically. Like,
oh.
Up and down.
You're kind of doing the dolphin or a wave. Oh, a wave.
The wave, right? You're going up ever so slightly, but immediately like going down and sliding. And so it was a way of getting across the screen super quickly, avoiding attacks, but also getting over to your opponent so fast. And if you did it correctly, it kind of made a little bit of, it wasn't smoke, but like a flash come underneath your character mm-hmm. and just looked super cool, but super effective way of moving.
Wave dashing, it's super effective.
Super effective.
But thank you, Mr. Nice Guy, for helping me with that, because I know that it is influential. And I think coming from me, I just wouldn't be able to put it as poetically as you. So thank you. But I do have one other Mr. Nice Guy. And this, I don't know how influential it necessarily is, but it's definitely what I conceive of when I think of a driving game, or what I want out of a driving game. And that came out in 2014 for the PlayStation 4, Xbox One, and 360, called The Crew. Okay, so hear me out. The Crew is a driving game and has a terrible story. It's not at all that interesting. And even though the protagonist is incredibly uncompelling, he is primarily saved because he is voiced by our personal hero, Troy Baker, who does a great job with what he's given, but still not especially compelling. But what is amazing about the game is that in it, you can basically drive across a scaled down contiguous United States. Start driving west from New York. It's not like everything's been handcrafted. There is definitely some copy and pasting here and there, but as you move across different regions in the United States, it absolutely feels, you know, I drive across some areas in the western portion of the U.S., and it's just like, you know, I feel almost like I've been here before, you know, like I've driven those roads. An absolutely surreal and kind of fantastic experience in a driving game. It had lots of, you know, quests that you'd go on, driving challenges and all that. But what really I love about that game is just the ability to drive around areas that are approximations, yes, but pretty nice approximations of the United States, the world that they built, expansive. And I love expansive worlds. Mr. Nice Guy, I don't think that driving games are something that you do all that frequently. Am I right?
It's, you know what, it's not my favorite, but when there's one that has certain mechanics or is just graphically impressive, I will at least give it a shot. I don't consider, you know, Super Mario Kart to be a quote-unquote real driving game, right? It's an arcadey driving game, and it's a great experience. But, you know, I'll hop on Forza every once in a while just because it's so beautiful and it's fun to test out those other cars. But it's like a 10-minute thing for me. I'm not really into it.
Yeah, I think the thing that certainly struck me about this being different from other, you know, driving games was just that idea of the sort of open road. You know, that is something that I certainly feel like calls to me personally from time to time. I want to drive in real life down roads I've never known before. And so a video game that can kind of evoke that wanderlust, satisfy that wanderlust, is, I feel, something special. So I wish we kind of had a few more open world driving options out there. And now granted, we do. We have things with like Euro Truck Simulator, but this one felt different and particularly enjoyed. I'm being told that Burnout Paradise and Forza Horizon have pretty solid open world drive options as well. And yeah, those things are absolutely fun rather than just showing up on a track, you know? Because how many times do you want to drive the Nuremberg? How many times do you want to drive that same or those same famous tracks? They might be fantastic, but at the end of the day, they're tracks. And sometimes you just want to chill out, put on some synthwave beats, and drive into the sunset is all I'm saying. So anyway, it may not be the most influential game in gaming history, but I think it's an overlooked one. So that's what I had for history for you. at least for this week.
Fantastic. Now, we switch between segments right now. We sometimes do Indie Game of the Week. I think for the rest of the year, just to let the viewers know, we probably will chill on that. We've played a lot of great games this year, and Mac and I have discussed some ways to celebrate them later on. But at the same time, we can only play so many games. So this week, we're going to be talking about the topic of the week, a segment where we talk about something relevant in gaming and discuss our opinions on it. Mac, I want to take a cue here from Kat Bailey and Alex Stedman at IGN on this story. Here's what they write, what they wrote. Just moments after it leaked on social media, Rockstar Games has officially revealed the trailer for Grand Theft Auto 6. The trailer, which you can watch below in the article, also confirms that it's coming in 2025, and the title is indeed simply Grand Theft Auto 6 for now. No specific release dates were revealed. The trailer gives us a look at the game's female protagonist, a first for the series. Her name is Lucia, and that she starts off in prison. Bad luck, I guess, she quips. The trailer confirms, too, that it's set in Vice City with a large sign. Not a huge surprise for those of us who have been following the series, but exciting nonetheless. They go on and on and on to describe the game. Mac, one thing we know about this game is that when it comes out in 2025, it has been announced that it will be released on Xbox Series systems as well as the PlayStation 5. No mention of PC. Would love to get your thoughts on that to start. And then I have a second question for you. Limited release, PC not available. What are your thoughts, man?
One could argue it's their decision if they want to leave money on the table by not, by not giving people in the PC realm a crack at it. There are dozens of us. Dozens! And, you know, if they don't want that money, well, it is unfortunate because I understand, and I think we understand generally, that exclusives are what are going to sell hardware, right? So we can't hold it against a company if they do an exclusive to, say, one specific console. But the ability to have parity across all systems is certainly there, and especially if you're going to release something for Xbox, I'm given to understand, though not a developer myself, I'm given to understand that developing something for the series winds up being not a far jump to put something on, you know, on Windows as well, or on, you know, PCs. I'm a little confused.
Well, and that's the thing is, you know, they'll probably release it on their own social club app. At some point on PC, mm-hmm. and then probably later they'll release it on Steam. We've seen this a lot. You know, Blizzard just did this with Diablo 4. And so maybe it's just the staggered release kind of rehypes the game up. Another person who I was reading from said GTA, or rather Rockstar, doesn't have the most cordial relationship with modders. And so maybe in the beginning, they don't want people focusing on modding the game. They want them to just enjoy it. Who knows? I think they should just release it on PC day one, get all your money, and then, you know, have updates, and people, candidly, who are already playing on PC can continue to give you money for the virtual currency and the skins and all that. But if it's not there, they can't do that. That leads me to my second question for you, Mac. It was 2013, I believe, I'll have to fact check myself, when GTA 5 first came out on the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. This new game will be coming out 2025, 12 years later. We've had Grand Theft Auto Online for well over a decade. People have put time in it. People have put money in it. It still has a very active community doing heists, doing GTA RP, which is GTA roleplay, doing all types of things. What do you think is the most effective way for Rockstar to transition the online aspect of the game to GTA 6, or do they not transition it at all?
You know, nice guy, last episode, one of the things we talked about was NBA 2K.
Yeah.
And the fact that every single year, nothing comes forward. Even the things that could easily be brought forward, such as, and correct me if I'm wrong, it was My Player, right?
Correct, yeah, My Player.
It's something that isn't tied to the specific rosters. It's something that you built, that you kind of leveled and personalized. In a game like this, where it isn't exactly tied to a thing like a roster or whatever, you would think that maybe the technological capacity might be there to let people bring their custom characters in or their custom skins and whatever. But that's probably not going to be quite as good for the sales and the microtransactions. Being able to ask for those purchases once again. And so on the one hand, I know I'm the biggest person who's just like, oh, you know, everything, you should always support stuff forever. And I think a game running like GTA Online for 10 years is a pretty decent run for a game. And maybe I just feel that way because the Overton window has shifted and everything else, you know, every couple of days we hear about a game being shut down after 2. And so I'm like, 10 years, that's pretty good, especially when, you know, but it's not really that good since we can plug in the old console controllers and play it right now here. I'm sorry, I digress. Most effective way for them to bring people on board probably going to be to let them go ahead and bring over their custom character. I think that would be a great way to help, you know, help adoption of the new game. What do you think, Mr. Nice Guy?
The one, I think that those are all good ideas. The one thing I would differentiate between NBA 2K and GTA is, as you mentioned, that is an annual release, NBA 2K. And so I think there's a little more frustration there, or at least there's a more frequent frustration there of, I just built this character and now you won't let me move it over. That's kind of that concept of fool me once, shame on me, fool me twice, or fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on you. I'm doing the George Bush thing, right? I can't even get the quote right.
You won't get fooled again.
You won't get fooled again. Fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. Where if you keep buying the game every year and you keep paying and then not being able to get what you want out of it, that's kind of your own fault. With this, it's actually going to be 12 years between releases. Now, what I think is going to happen with GTA is there's a reason they named it GTA Online and not GTA 5 Online. Is I think that there's going to be some type of integration between your GTA Online profile and whatever they add that comes with GTA 6. I don't believe that they don't add extra content or upgrade the graphics or do some type of overhaul. But I also don't think that they just tell people to leave all of what they've done over the past 12 years behind. Games as a service are a new thing. And I think that they've built so much trust in the community that they don't want to take advantage of that. I think that GTA Online continues, but there's some updates and some tweaks if you buy the new game. Now, here's the thing that's really interesting about it too, Mac, is how can they do that when it's not coming out on PC day one? They can't limit their PC players to say you have to play this old version, but there's a new version on the consoles, especially when I believe it's all crossplay. So and I could be wrong about that, but it's just interesting to think that a segment of the population will get access to new online stuff while the PC people may not. And that's where it's very confusing about that not coming out day one. So those are my thoughts, man. I hope they let people keep playing their old characters and their old apartments and their old businesses that they've built. But we will see. Any other comments, Mac?
Just that it would be quite a shame to lose that kind of progress, especially the love that people have for it.
Yeah, 100%. Now, Rockstar, one of the best in all of gaming, in my opinion. I can't wait to see what they do. This game is going to be dope. That has been our topic of the week.
Well, now we turn to a crowdfunding project that's trying to get off the ground. We call this Kick or Kickstart. I have posted a link in the chat to the project we're going to take a gander at. Mr. Nice Guy has never seen this before. Can you confirm?
I can confirm.
So we're going to get his real thoughts in real time. This Kickstarter project, we're going to say whether or not we think it should be kicked out of here or it should be kickstarted. So let's talk about the virtues and or the vices. This is Star Racer, a retro-inspired sci-fi racing game with fast-paced road and aerial combat. Basically, what you're seeing there is an SNES F-Zero style game. Limited energy, some burnout style bumper car action, aerial combat, and perhaps most interesting, a track editor as part of the game. I believe that that local split screen is supported from the jump on this game. And this will be a Steam release, although they do have stretch goals for ports and also stretch goals for an online versus multiplayer. They were looking at $20,000 to fund this. It has successfully smashed that goal and is at about just shy of $25,000 currently. The minimum buy-in's actually pretty decent at $10, and the expected delivery is to be March of this upcoming year, so a mere 3 months away, which is a pretty blistering turnaround for most Kickstarters. So very impressive it does it, even if they wind up going, you know, farther than that, like double the length, and this is winds up being, say, a June release, that is still pretty fast in comparison. They are planning on releasing this at $15 on Steam, so it's like a 30-something odd percent discount if you hop in there, and there's still about 100 of those left if you want to grab those early birds. It really hits a lot of the right notes for this style. I don't know how I backed myself into the corner of vehicle and driving-themed stuff today, but hey, it just happened. Mr. Nice Guy, anything jump out at you here?
Yeah, I obviously made the F-Zero connection very, very quickly. Like, that's blatant. It looks like they kind of added, like, some... You ever watch those old-school Batmans with Adam West?
Uh-huh.
Where it's like, boom, pow, when you would punch people? I'm noticing as the cars run into each other, it has that little effect on the screen. I think that's dope. I think that's very a nice touch. I'm a little surprised that Nintendo has not come after them for this. Because it may not be the same assets in terms of artwork, but it's very clear what they're doing here, right?
Oh, yeah.
The other thing that's interesting, and I know you're not a Switch owner, F-Zero 99 is a big thing right now. And so there's basically a Battle Royale version of F-Zero that is on the Switch right now that's free if you have Nintendo Switch Online, where people could get their F-Zero itch scratched. So it's not like there's a huge void for this type of game, and F-Zero 99 is awesome. I've played it a few times. I think that these good people making this game are fighting an uphill battle, both from a legal perspective and from a niche perspective, but they've hit their goal, and I think that this looks like it could be fun.
I do take some comfort in the fact that Nintendo, while notoriously litigious, and the second they catch whiff of anything, they are the first to be there and threaten you into the ground. And the fact that this is still up leads me to believe that maybe they've already passed that hurdle. I hope, possibly. I can dream. But, you know, I will say, though, Mr. Nice Guy, I feel like it hits all the right notes, but for a game that's as far along as it is, something like this really ought to have a playable demo. And you know what? It does have one. A playable demo right there, not quite right at the top, but pretty darn close. So if you happen to be interested in it, you can go to, and it'll be a demo on Steam. So you can go ahead and play it on Steam, whether you're on your Steam Deck or otherwise. One thing that is very exciting to me about this is that there is a level editor, obviously, but one of the things they say is that you, as the end user, will basically get access to all the same tools that they used to make the game in the first place for doing the level editing. And that's really what pushes this from good to great, in my opinion, is being able to make your own tracks and being able to share them. There is even the stretch goal for making your maps shareable online so that you can play you know, the maps and share them. And that's only at the $40,000 mark. And they're, I think they're going to make it there. So yeah. Anyway, all that is to say, I'm a fan of this. A hearty kickstart from me.
Yeah, I am not like over the moon about this. But I think it's dope that they are doing their thing. It's a little bit...
Let me have this one. I need a non-Nintendo F-Zero.
I will always absolutely say what I believe in terms of if I want these things to be... Or if I think these things deserve to be kickstarted. Yeah. And I do think that this one does, Mac. I have no problem with this. I mean, it's not like we have tons and tons of F-Zero games that are being made. We have tons of racers. Mm. There's F-Zero 99, so there's stuff out there. But yeah, I think that this should be kickstarted. I have no problem with it, other than the fact that they're fighting an uphill battle, and I hope that this game gets made.
Yes, we both wish you guys the best. Whatnot Games! Star Racer does look fun. Thank you for bringing some of that cheer. That is an F-Zero style game, bringing that to a platform that I own. So thank you. Kickstart from the both of us. I know that there is, that there is some hesitancy by those in the chat, but here's to hoping that this goes forward. That's been Kick or Kickstart.
Well, now it is time for Nerd Flex.
Woo-hoo.
A segment where you, the viewers, try to stump the hosts. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. And this week's episode is a special one, Mac. Why don't you tell the people why?
It's special because we have a sound test this episode. Every about fourth episode, we turn the tables. You bring those cool, nerdy, multiple-choice gaming-related questions to us each week. This is our version of picking up the gauntlet and throwing it back at you with a mystery sound from somewhere, somewhen, somehow in video gaming. Go ahead, have a listen. And let us know whether that's on social medias or whether getting back to us in Discord or just a good old-fashioned email back to us. Let us know that you're referring to this episode, episode 291, and use the hashtag soundtest for your guesses. First one to do it gets a prize, lovingly handcrafted by me and sent to you. So with no further ado, good luck. You'll need it.
Fantastic. Well, as you know, if you're here live, you have a job to do. Get your multiple choice gaming related questions in the chat. Mac and I will use nothing but our noggins to try to answer them. And we're going to go with this first one from my good friend of the show, Spenis the Menace 7. He writes, in Super Smash Bros. Melee, how many hours of gameplay on versus mode is required at minimum for one player to unlock Mewtwo? 10, 15, 20, or 25. Mac, what are your thoughts?
What even is Melee? But real talk. Yeah, I have no idea. My inclination is to lean to the middle of the distribution and say like 20. But man, that's a lot of hours inside of a versus mode, especially when those game sections, those rounds go pretty fast.
It's interesting because he put one player in caps.
Mm.
So it leads me to believe that the answer is different for two players.
Mm.
Regardless, I don't know the answer concretely off the top of my head. And I do feel like it would be an even number. I feel like 10 is too short. And I agree with you that we should go with 20. Final answer.
20 final answer. We'll see. We did it! The answer is 20 for one person. The number can be reduced through the number of players playing, so it can be done in as little as 5 hours with 4 people playing. Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
It does make sense. Great question from Spenis. Let's go to the test bank. People are being a little shy with the questions today, and that is okay. Mac, it's funny because we got a Melee question. We were talking about Melee from Spenis. We got a Rockstar question, and I'm starting to wonder if people are going to think that we're cheating. Because it seems like too big a coincidence. Should I still go with this question, or should we move on?
I say go with it, Mr. Nice Guy. We're definitely going to get it wrong.
Okay, so here's the question. In what year was the first GTA game released?
I want to say something like 94. give or take.
It's got to be 90 something, because I like GTA 3 was like 2001, if I remember correctly. So that means there were at least two before that, and they were like the top down Zelda style of view, which we talked about earlier. So I mean, what, like 3 years between games, maybe? You're probably right. 94, 95.
Well, it's not multiple choice, so we can go with whatever. I'll stick with my original by guess and by golly of 1994, if you feel compelled.
And I will go with 96.
Okay.
Final answer. Let's see what the answer is. Mac, we were both close. And it was actually 1997 was the first GTA.
We were close. You much closer than me. But neither of us went over. So by Price is Right rules, Mr. Nice Guy, you won that one. Well, we do have one last question in the chat here from Galvatron.
Go for it.
Which is, which one of these characters is not a member of the Lin Kuei, I think that's how you're supposed to say that, ninja clan? Is it Sub-Zero, Scorpion, Cyrax, Sektor, Noob Saibot, Frost, or Smoke? Okay, so my Mortal Kombat knowledge is not especially good. I think Cyrax or Sektor, one of those is supposed to be a robot. And I guess you could ask, can a robot be a part of a ninja clan? And that's where I would lean. But also at the same time, I feel like Scorpion, there's some lore in there about Scorpion like betraying the ninja clan or something. And that's why he and Sub-Zero hate each other so much. And that leads me to wonder if maybe it's Scorpion by virtue of being kicked out of the ninja clan. There's a lot of different ways I could go with this.
Yeah, and I'm not a huge Mortal Kombat person. I know Sub-Zero and Scorpion. I did not know there was a character named Noob Saibot. I actually think that might be made up.
Can confirm, is a real character.
Is a real character, okay. Mac, I'm gonna follow you on this one. Which one do you think is the right answer?
I'll go with Cyrax, because I think Cyrax is the robot, and I think, yeah, reasoning as previous.
All right.
How can a robot be a, you know, be a ninja?
Be a real ninja, because they're not quiet, and you'd constantly having to be oiling the joints to keep them ninja-like and stealthy and quiet, WD-40 and that thing, so.
Oh, I was right the second time. Scorpion. And I wonder if it is because of that thing. Like I said, I knew that there was some lore about Scorpion betraying the clan. Solid question, but sadly just wasn't there this time around.
That is all right. Thanks for playing, everybody.
Well, now we turn to a little bit of legalese.
Legalese.
I'm not a lawyer. I just play one on a podcast. And last time, last episode, that's episode 290 for those of you playing the home game, when we, which did just barely go up, apologies, I was traveling all last week, but, you know, we got the episode up. We talked about the 2K virtual currency case. And afterward, I actually got some follow-up questions about the current legal state of individual arbitration in the EULAs that video games have. So just for you, listener lovely shades, I want to share the most recent case. That's Hydebrider v. Epic Games. And that was from just early 2020 out of the Fourth Circuit, specifically North Carolina. The background was that during the period of 2018 to 2019, there were fraudulent charges on a player's credit card that came from Fortnite hackers. I'll put that in quotes, because the credit card data was almost more leaked than hacked. And they specifically sued Epic for their lack of proper data security. With respect to the cards. You know, if you were doing what you were supposed to be doing, I wouldn't have had these transactions because they got the data from you. Now, side note, it is important to remember that Epic, at this exact moment in time, was also ignoring over 1 million complaints about Epic themselves wrongfully charging for purchases in Fortnite. This was something that we learned back in December 2022 during that settlement with the FTC. listen to episode 251 for more information. Epic has never been your friend. Sorry, side note aside. Back to Hidebreader, who sued because of Epic not safeguarding the credit card information. As the suit came forward, the complaint was issued, and Epic moved to compel arbitration as per the end user license agreement. And the issue became, if you agreed to binding individual arbitration in the EULA with Epic, how can you bring them to court? And the arbitration had a few specific clauses that became at issue as part of the back and forth. It was you can arbitrate only on an individual basis, you know, to protect Epic from getting any class actions coming after them. Two, a delegation to the arbiter to determine whether a specific dispute fell within the binds of the arbitration clause. Three, venue selection. Four, a fee-sharing provision for the arbitration, which that's not really going to come into play here, but is interesting on its own. And five, the right for users to opt out of the arbitration provision for a limited time after agreeing to the EULA by snail mailing within 30 days, stating and telling Epic that you wanted out of the binding arbitration or not agreeing to the EULA and never turning the video game on again. So, with that as all the big background, Hidebreader argued three reasons why he shouldn't be compelled to arbitrate, and Lam, I want to ask you.
Please.
Do you think they said yay or nay on any of these three? The first is because Hidebreader said he didn't agree to the terms that were updated in 2019. And while his child may have clicked the agree button, a minor didn't have the legal capacity to accept the contract. What do you think, nice guy?
Am I saying that he was correct in that or no?
Did you think that he won that, or do you think that they were like, nah, that's not good enough?
I'm going to say what should happen is he should win that.
Okay.
So yes, let's say he won it.
Sadly, you're wrong, Mr. Nice Guy. The court ruled that under basic principles of principal agent law, the child was acting as his agent and had both actual and apparent authority to agree to the end user license agreement and to bind him to that end user license agreement. All right. How about the second one?
Okay.
That privacy-related claims were outside of the scope of the arbitration provision. That his credit card data being stored improperly was outside of the bounds of the interaction between him and Epic. That this sort of cybersecurity isn't within the bounds of the player-playee, or of the player-game-maker relationship.
What year was this case before I answer that?
2020.
Okay. So, I mean, just because he already lost the thing about it not being a minor issue and that the minor was acting as his agent, I'm going to guess he lost this one as well.
You are right, Mr. Nice Guy. He also lost this one. The court said, hey, the arbitration, you know, agreement says that the arbiter gets to decide what is part and what is not part of the arbitration. So, yeah, that's part of the arbitration as well. All right. Third, final one. The arbitration-related provisions were unconscionable because they applied retroactively to prior claims that occurred before the EULA was agreed to. He specifically argued that Epic knew that the breaches, that the data breaches, had been happening at the time, and they updated the EULA to try and compel people to prevent them from coming after Epic for their, you know, mishandling of data, and didn't tell the users about it. Now, and that constitutes fraud. Now, this seems increasingly likely, given from what we learned about Epic from the 2022 settlement of the FTC. But anyway, that whole one that it's like, hey, you made these changes to the EULA specifically to cover your malfeasance. And so that's a knowing fraud that you engaged in. So they can't enforce this arbitration because they made these changes to cover fraud. What do you think about that one, Mr. Nice Guy? Sounds compelling?
It sounds compelling. I'm just going to, like, I don't even have my dice here. I was going to flip a coin. Let's do this real quick, Mac. We're going to bring some GURPS into the mix today.
Heck yeah.
So I pulled up, as you know, if you type 3d6 into Google, it gives you three dice and totals them up. So I'm going to roll these dice. If I get a 9 or below, yes. If I get a 10 or above, no.
Love it. Let's do it.
And I got an 8.
The court said no. The court said that Epic's earlier end-user license agreement said that they could amend it at any time with any or no notice at all, and that would be fine. So, yeah, you had the option to opt out of the arbitration provision by either never playing Fortnite again or by clicking yes and then snail mailing Epic and letting them know that you said no thank you to the binding arbitration, and you didn't do that, sir. So but too bad, so sad. Yeah, as sad as it is, that is the current state, at least in the Fourth Circuit, which has the most recent example of an end user license agreement, and specifically the arbitration clauses being evoked in court. Thanks so much, lovely shades, for asking about that. I feel like Nice Guy and I probably both agree that that's a bit much, but that is where we are at this moment from the legal perspective with respect to arbitration, and that is exactly why in last episode I was so very, yeah, this case is never going anywhere, if for no other reason than just the arbitration, it's sunk at that level. So, you know, that's not the law, but it is some legalese.
Love it, love it, love it, love it. Well done, as always, my friend. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Before we go, we have one last segment called What We've Been Watching and What We've Been Playing, where we talk about just that. If you're here live, you got a job to do. Let us know what you're playing, because we always are looking for cool, nerdy stuff to get into. Mac, my friend, what have you been watching and playing?
I went to the Marvels movie over the weekend.
Okay.
And while I've been watching a little bit of television here and there, that's the big one, is the Marvels movie. And, you know, I enjoyed it. It could have been better, and I feel like there's a couple of times in it specific that I have thoughts of, and I'll share one if you don't mind, but it's not a spoiler.
Yeah.
It involves Monica Rambeau, it involves Miss Marvel, and it involves Kamala, who's the girl in the Disney Plus, in the television series. So that's no spoilers, but there is a moment where Captain Marvel, Alison Brie, she's doing something. Rambo's like, hey, what's going on? And Kamala says she's going with the flow, talking about, you know, Captain Marvel. And there's this, and it was said in that way that made you feel like, oh, that's a callback to a previous conversation. But unless I, like, fell asleep during the, you know, first 20 minutes of the show, which I'm pretty sure I didn't, I don't know, I am getting old, that conversation never happened. But it had that tone of, oh, it's a callback to a conversation. You know, it's just like, oh, did I just suddenly miss the part where they talked about, oh, she needs to learn to go with the flow, and then this happens, she's going with the flow. Anyway, but it was little things like that that I felt at various points in time, like something got cut in the edit, and now this spot nothing doesn't work anymore. That's my big gripe. But for the most part, it was very enjoyable.
Okay, good to know. That was going to be my question. Anything else, Mac? What you been playing?
I've been playing almost exclusively Dark Souls. It's been a great source of anger and frustration lately for me. But yeah, good old-fashioned Dark Souls 1.
On the Steam Deck, or how you playing it?
On the Steam Deck, indeed, because I've been away from the computer a lot lately. But yeah, how about you, Mr. Nice Guy? What have you been watching and playing?
You know, I haven't had as much time as normal to play stuff.
Really? Hosting 70-plus people doesn't lend itself to lots of video gaming?
It really doesn't, man. It does for the kids that came, but not for me. Not for me. Host extraordinaire, man. I have been playing, or rather watching, a lot of Christmas movies. So we have a list of movies we watch every year. It seems like every year one or two gets added. We've made it through The Home Alones. We've made it through Jingle All the Way. There's a new series on Disney Plus called The Santa Claus featuring Tim Allen and others. And it's like a weekly episodic show. So it's been interesting to kind of watch that universe expand past the three movies that they made. And a few others. We watched The 99 on Netflix. That's a new one. Last year, we added to the list 8-Bit Christmas, which if you're a gamer and you like retro stuff, I think that it's a cool journey of a kid looking to get his first Nintendo back in the 80s. Super cool movie. As far as playing, I've gotten a little bit of Diablo 4 in, but just haven't had as much time as I'd like to really play video games, which is understandable. It's the holiday season, been doing that. Mac, what are people into in the chat? They're quiet this week.
Indeed. We'll give Galvatron his due. He's been watching Godzilla Minus One, Wish, Napoleon, Onimusha, and Formula One Drive to Survive. As for playing, Super Mario Brothers Wonder, Lies of P, Jedi Survivor, Spider-Man 2, Remnant 2, and Lords of the Fallen.
Nice. I will say, I got about 5 minutes of Remnant 2 in because it's on Game Pass. And then my stream stopped and it didn't save my progress. So I got to do that 5 to 10 minutes over again. But it seems like a fun game.
Well, at least it's just 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's not a big deal. I can't complain about that. Well, thank you everybody for tuning in. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah. Happy Kwanzaa. All the other stuff y'all celebrate. We appreciate y'all being here. Please leave ratings, like, subscribe. Gaming is art. Be excellent to each other. Be kind. And we'll see y'all next week. Deuces.
Bye.